Any theory or hypothesis which has no objective evidence to base it is merely subjective. Why should anyone believe that you have a corner on the truth unless there's a shareable ground that you and I can equally validate?
Welcome to Purposeful Lab, a Maja Center podcast. I'm Catherine Hadro with my co-host, Dr. Daniel Keebler. And here we are as we are kicking off season 5. I can't believe it.
Yeah, our fifth and final season of the podcast.
And it really, this season will really round out our mission and our goal. And as we're looking at the abundant order in the universe and in the human person, and this season we'll be focusing on human flourishing and what that looks like in different forms.
Yeah. We looked at a little bit about human flourishing. But one of the themes that's come up is how humans are not meant to live in isolation. We live in community, and how even like our brain development is a communal thing. Like the brain is a relational organ, and how we're meant to be in community. But then the question is, how do you best live in community, right? And how do we flourish as a human community rather than just an individual, right?
And our first guest who we'll be speaking with today is Father Robert Spitzer. We'll be speaking about that very subject with him. Of course, we had Father Spitzer on in season 1. If you know Maja Center, you know Father Spitzer. But just as a refresher about who he is, he's a priest in the Jesuit order and currently the president of the Maja Center, previously the president of Gonzaga University. Father Spitzer has taught courses on faith and reason, metaphysics, philosophy of God, and philosophy of science. He's published at least 15 books at this point. I lost track as I was counting, including a 2011 book that we'll be focusing in on today, one of his most popular, called 10 Universal Principles, A Brief Philosophy of the Life Issues. And again, with Father Spitzer, we'll be looking about how we flourish together as a society and natural law and what happens when we as a culture veer off of these rules.
Right. And can we actually come to any consensus on how to live if you don't have these to ground your discussion and your interactions with your community?
Yes. And it really sets us off, I think, nicely for the rest of the season, just to give a little preview as to what's ahead as we'll be focused on this topic of human flourishing. We're going to be really delving into the topic of art. What is art? You know, what is good art? And what that looks like too, even philosophy and art together. Also, the reality of suffering and how psychology, you know, can help be a means to healing suffering and addressing suffering as well. And St. Edith Stein, who I'm personally excited to learn more about.
Yeah. And I think all of these sort of look at, you know, the human person and how we interact with other people and how we actually can flourish, you know, psychologically, socially, and artistically, which is art is meant to of a way to communicate with other people, right? It's not meant to, you don't make art for yourself. It's a communal thing, even though one person does it for the community. Yeah.
Well, again, to kick us off with season 5, here is our interview with Father Robert Spitzer. Father Spitzer, thank you for joining us once again. It's always a joy to see you and to speak with you. In our previous season, we talked about human flourishing, which we'll be looking at in season 5 as well. But we want to kick off this season talking about how we flourish together as a society, as a culture. And you hit on that in one of your most popular books, 10 Universal Principles, A Brief Philosophy of the Life Issues. And in that introduction, you emphasize the significance of teaching and practicing these principles so that you prevent the decline of culture and ensure human dignity. To kick us off, Father Spitzer, can you elaborate what is the historical evidence that supports the dire consequences that happen when we do not follow these principles?
Right. So a culture and a society are very different from a state or a government or a governmental system. You could have extrinsic structures that help the government to work and that help the court system to work and help the legislative process to proceed. But really, what you need for a culture or a society to work is you need the principles and the values which animate people. You need them to work, what we would call, we need high-minded principles and values to not only be instilled in our people, that they learn these principles, which are the principles that have really helped us, since truly the 1200s, where many of these are developed, some were developed way before 1200. But the main thing is these are the basic principles that govern not just the individual human heart, but the interconnected human heart. It governs our society, which is not reducible to a state. A state is the governmental system and so forth that runs the laws that run the state. But the society has a heart. The culture is the heart of the society.
Okay, Father. So you've talked, there about culture making these correct decisions as a culture of what they value and so forth. And you've got these 10 universal principles, and you've divided them, or they fall under sort of four broad categories, right? The reason, ethics, justice, and natural rights, and then this golden rule as the last one. So why don't we jump into sort of the first one, reason, and look at the first principle, the principle of complete explanation. And how does this guide us in determining, the best theories and opinions as in a cultural context?
Right. Well, the main thing to remember here is that we live in a society right now where truth is relative, right? So and relativity of the truth means we can sort of believe anything we want. Rational justification is really not needed. Everybody has an opinion, and all opinions are equally valid. Honestly, if I go into a classroom today and I ask a group of freshmen, I mean college freshmen, how many people think that all people's opinions are equally valid? Half the class will raise their hand in agreement with that proposition, which of course would be the abdication of any kind of rational process upon which a culture could be organized or proceed. So it's mass intellectual suicide. So these three principles that come really from Plato and Aristotle, that's when they were first formulated, are really important. Complete explanation is important. Non-contradiction is important. And objective evidence is important. Let's just take a look at this first one, namely complete explanation. Basically, since the time of Plato and Aristotle, everybody would agree that the explanation that explains the most about reality, that doesn't leave out whole chunks of reality, will be the best explanation. In science, there are so many examples of this. For many, many years, Newtonian physics reigned supreme. But there was this too little unaccounted for facts. And the Michelson-Morley experiments, which showed that light actually had a finite velocity and that it regulated things, and a variety of other processes like the ether could not be sustained, which is part of the Newtonian viewpoint. And then later we found the curvature of spacetime. And so a fellow came along by the name of Albert Einstein. And he had another explanation for physics and for the universe that accounted for all of these things. Curvature of space-time, relativity of space, and of course the finite velocity of light, et cetera, et cetera. And so that, it was the more complete explanation. Nobody in the scientific community said, let's go back to Newton. He was a much better, explainer of reality. Newton was a genius. He did what he could for his time, but Einstein had the better explanation. He came closer to the truth because his explanation accounted for more data. It was more comprehensive and complete.
Well, also in this first category of reason, and you've already mentioned it, there's the principle of non-contradiction, which is also fundamental to logical reasoning. Talk us through this principle.
Yeah, I mean, since, Plato wrote a dialogue called The Sophists, and in it he just pokes fun at this group of individuals named the Sophists, who basically held that, your objective was to persuade people to your opinion, regardless of whether it corresponded to the truth or not. So in this dialogue, The Sophist, Plato starts poking fun. He begins to say, okay, so basically you can have a square circle, right, of the same area in the same respect at the same place and time. And obviously you can see that the boundaries of a square with its four inscribed right angles are going to be very different from the boundaries of a circle, which has no inscribed right angles. And of course you can't have, no inscribed and four inscribed right angles in the same respect at the same place and time in the same area. It's absolutely impossible. And so we always said a contradiction's a bad thing. It immediately indicates falsity. So if you're saying by your theory that John can be 6'3" and 6'4" in the same respect at the same place and time, that you can have a square circle, the same area, the same respect, same place and time, automatically you know that's wrong. You know that it's false for any possible universe in any possible condition. And we call those things universal truths. So basically, you can't ignore that fact. Any theory, then, which has intrinsic contradictions in it, is a bad theory. Any theory which, forces you to say X and not X in the same respect at the same place and time is a false theory and hypothesis, and you cannot hold that. I mean, of course, the Marxists tried to hold that, but you can't build a plumbing system in the Kremlin on Marxist dialectical principles. So we're back to good old non-contradiction. Science is grounded in non-contradiction. Mathematics is grounded in non-contradiction. Logic is grounded in non-contradiction. You can't get around it, and anybody who tries to ignore it comes up with the most absurd and, obviously untenable kinds of theories in the world. But we need to teach our young people this, because we can't have somebody, for example, a Supreme Court saying, oh, well, there's no precedent in the Constitution, for the humanity of the fetus. And then in the next breath, turn right around and say, however, a fetus, a preborn human being, has the rights of inheritance. And of course, the mother can sue on behalf of a fetus that's injured, say, in a car accident when still in utero, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Hey, wait a minute. That's contradictory. You can't say that a non-human being has the right of inheritance. The non-human being has the right to sue. The non-human being can force you to be criminally prosecuted for injuring it. And of course, not be a human being. And then turn right around and say, oh, we don't have any precedent in the Constitution that a preborn human being is human. I mean, it's just absurd. Again, it's contradictory. And by the way, before it was reversed by Dobbs, the Roe v. Wade had many contradictions in it. And we saw the same thing in Dred Scott versus Sanford, the Supreme Court decision where remarkably, the Supreme Court of the United States unanimously decided that there was no precedent to guarantee the rights of a Negro or African-American human beings, and that therefore it was constitutionally and humanely acceptable for Black people to be subjugated in slavery, treated like chattel by the superior race, namely white people. And you look at that and you go, well, wait a minute. How does that jive with our Declaration of Independence, that all human beings are created equal with the inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? Well, that's a liberty right there. How can you claim, on the one hand, in your Declaration of Independence, which is the grounding document from which we separated from Britain and declared ourselves as a people to be in existence, how can you declare it there that there's a right to liberty for every single human being and then turn right around and say, oh, well, there's no constitutional precedence for this, so go ahead and enslave Black people to white people. You can go ahead and subjugate them. And a unanimous Supreme Court decision.
That's great examples there of that principle of non-contradiction and the issues you get when you ignore that. So the last one of the principles in the reason category is this principle of objective evidence. And this is one that seems to be under assault in our culture where, you know, online you can assert anything and not have to verify it and nobody knows what's true or what's not. And so, take us through this and the issues that arise when you ignore this principle of objective evidence.
Yeah, going back to Plato again, any theory or hypothesis, which has no objective evidence on which to base it, is merely subjective. Says it's a mere matter of your individual state of mind. And of course, Plato asks the question: why should anyone believe that you have a corner on the truth? Unless there's some objective ground, objective means outside ground, a shareable ground that you and I can equally validate. So he says, if we don't have an objective basis or objective evidence for the truth, how can you expect me to believe you because you said it, but you can't give me any objective basis, anything which we can share together where I can say, yeah, I believe that. I think that's true. Now, there are two kinds of objective evidence. There's a priori evidence and a posteriori evidence. Let's begin with the latter, the a posteriori evidence. That's the kind of, sensation. So do you believe my finger exists? Okay, you can see it. I can see it. We can share the experience. We can validate it together. There's something that we can, a common basis that we can share. But it's not just in my head. You see it too. You can validate it with me. That's going to be the best way. Otherwise, if we don't do that, we're going to wind up saying, hey, you just got to trust me. I have a corner on the truth. Just as I used to say to my mother, Mom, just believe me. And my mother, oh, I can't believe you. Okay. So, I mean, the point is pretty clear. We don't want to believe that anybody has a corner on the truth. We want to see for ourselves. That is what we call, a normal expectation in any kind of a rational dialogue is to have that shareable evidence. And a priori evidence is the same way. For example, if I say A squared plus B squared equals C squared, right, the great Pythagorean theorem, I expect that, you should expect that I can prove that if I get a certain set of axioms and principles, that I can use those axioms and principles and show you through pure non-contradictory logic that this has to be the case and that A squared plus B cubed equals C squared cannot be true. So in other words, just think of a priori as having a rational proof based on non-contradiction and logic. So if you've got those two kinds of objective evidence, you are in good shape. In other words, we're at the point where we can actually show, share together the data, the evidence, and then, of course, we can then together have our own individual assessment. Is this based on objective evidence, which I can verify? If so, great. Are there any contradictions in it? If not, great. And is this the most complete explanation or is there some other that we need to consider? If so, then great. Then once we've got it put together, we can say, that's reasonable and responsible. You say, well, I don't want to say and declare outright that it's true. Maybe we'll discover something later. Okay, you don't have to say that it's the truth for all the centuries. But right now, on the basis of the evidence that we can give, this is a reasonable and responsible belief, and that is as close to the truth as we can get in any given time. And of course, if you don't want to, lapse into solipsism and skepticism, that's the best anybody can do. Science is based on it. Logic is based on it. Metaphysics is based on it. Mathematics is based on it. And at the end of the day, those things having been based on it, that's what makes us rational people. Instead of just a bunch of emoters, instead of just a bunch of people who are expecting one another to have a corner of the truth. If you don't have these three principles in place, all we can do is emote. All we can do is shout at each other. All we can never prove anything to anybody. We have no criterion to show that one opinion is better than another. The only way, if we're going to avoid the shouting matches and the sheer stupidity of emotion blinded to reason, the only way of getting, you know, culture off the ground and making progress, and of course making compromises and trying to get into a very civil and orderly business, the only way are these three principles. Frankly, relativity of truth is just a killer. And of course, as you've already said, it's out the gate, and we need to bring the three principles back to bear again.
No, we need this reminder because there's definitely a lot of shouting happening in our culture as well. So again, that was the reason category. Pivoting now and looking at the category of ethics. I want to start off with the principle of non-maleficence.
This is like, you know, Kevin, the silver rule. So everybody knows the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. The silver rule is actually the more general rule, and it's everywhere present in every culture. And the silver rule has the nots in it. Do not do unto others what you would not have them do unto you. So you go, well, why is that the most fundamental principle of ethics? Why does everything hinge on that? Because we could briefly translate it as, don't do a harm to others you don't want done to you. Or if we shortened it, you could just say, look, avoid unnecessary harms, but if a harm is unavoidable, then minimize it. That's the minimum we can do for each other, to avoid unnecessary harms and to minimize unavoidable harm. So that's basically, we call it the most basic rule, because if that falls, if you are going to permit people to do unnecessary harms to others, or to go ahead and maximize harms to others, if you're going to permit them to do that, then there is no ethics, there is no justice, there is no respect, there is no restraint, in which case you not only have a pure lawlessness, a pure chaos within society, you've got basically a justification of sociopaths up within the society. In other words, you know, anybody who says, I really, in order for me to be fulfilled, I need to do harms to other people. All I can tell you right now is that run, Bambi, run first. And secondly, that person is a sociopath. They have no conscience. And because they have no conscience, they are going to be an El Destructo mechanism right out there in the middle of the world. And everyone they touch is really going to be harmed. Hardly a principle upon which culture and society of order and free dialogue and rational belief can occur. Hardly.
Yeah, the second ethical principle is this consistency between the ends and the means. That you can't use a immoral or unethical ends for an ethical, use an unethical means to get to an ethical ends, and vice versa. So what are the issues, particularly in contemporary culture? It seems like we try to justify everything that we want to do.
And of course, you know, this came out, during the 60s, you know, with Joseph Fletcher's situation ethics, and then a variety of emotivist ethics that were coming out, you know, that you could, as long as you were getting something that felt right, or in the end, you were getting to, Joseph Fletcher's principle, for example, was, you know, do the maximum good for others. And, you know, he called it neighbor welfare. So our objective in ethics, our sole objective in ethics, is to do the greatest amount of neighbor welfare for the greatest amount of people. Well, that's a very laudable end, but it doesn't talk about the means. And so can we use any means to get to that very laudable end? Can we use any means to get to the greatest amount of neighbor welfare? Well, the Maoists tried to do that. They said, look, all we want to do is get to a maximum economic advantage for China. All we have to do in order to do that is just move a whole lot of people out of the cities and into the rural areas. And, you know, look, I mean, we may lose, you know, 6-7 billion people, but I mean, 100 million people. But look, everybody else is going to, you know, really benefit from it. And you know, when you got as many people as we do, you know, 700 million, you know, that's an affordable loss. You know, that's collateral damage we can take. That is a sufficient means to get to our laudatory good end. And of course, first of all, no, it isn't. You can't. If you start using an evil means like killing off 700,000 people in order to get to, you know, a rebuilding of you know, the so-called great leap forward, the great cultural leap, economic leap forward, if you're going to do that, well, first of all, those people have rights, but we haven't talked about rights yet, but they are due some justice. You can't just arbitrarily kill off a bunch of people in order to maximize a good end. And why is that? Go back to the principle of non-maleficence. You can't do an unnecessary harm. You don't have to harm those people. If you want to get to the maximum good that you think you can get, then of course you say, well, I'm going to have to kill off some people. I'm going to have to starve out some people. I'm going to have to force some people to move who don't want to move. And if they don't want to move, I got to shoot them. So, I mean, the point is, of course, if you start thinking that way, you can't ignore the principle of non-maleficence in order to get to any laudatory good goal. So what does that mean? You have to use a means that is consistent with the end. You can't use things that are going to harm people unnecessarily. You can't use a means that is going to destroy somebody else's property or treat people unjustly in order to get to the great totalitarian end of Mao or Stalin or somebody of that nature. Every single human being is deserving of justice, is deserving of having non-maleficence, and do no unnecessary harm practiced in their favor, everybody. And so you have to keep this balance. And what St. Augustine, by the way, he's the one who first articulated it in logical form, is he basically said, not only do you do an injustice, not only do you do an unnecessary harm and violate the principle of non-maleficence against all these individuals in order to get to your end, if you're not going to have a consistency between means and ends, but the second thing is, it'll blow up your ideal goal anyway. In other words, if you're trying to get to a really good laudable end, and you're using a terribly harmful and evil means to get to your laudable end, it's always going to undermine not just the achievement of the end, it'll undermine the credibility of the end itself. In other words, you know, it's going to blow the whole thing up.
And Father, everything you're saying about how every person's deserving of this just means seems to flow in really nicely to this third ethical principle, which is the principle of full human potential, which advocates for valuing every human being. I mean, this seems like a principle that our culture really needs to hear.
Yeah, and of course, this is the universalizing of personhood. And as you probably know, well, of course, this goes back to the school of Salamanca, right, which is the great school of Francisco Suarez and a variety of other people who were dealing at that time with these new worlds were opening up in South America and North America, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, the capacity for exploitation of the African slaves, of, you know, the native peoples in South America, blah, all these, you know, different things you can absolutely see. You know, that this is ripe with exploitation going on at the time. And so, you know, the Salamanca folks just basically said, you know, the first thing is you can't make a distinction, you know, as to which human being is going to be honored. So go back to objective evidence today. We know what a human being is genetically. We know what a human being is through a series of capacities. You know, that can be measured. There's just no question anymore. But at the time, you know, in these colonization and the new worlds and so forth, it was thought, well, you know, there are subhuman beings and there are real human beings. In other words, if you start saying that one group of human beings is inferior and another group of human beings is superior, if you don't give equal valuation to every human being simply because they're human, if you start trying to make, well, a person with 110 IQ, sorry, inferior. A person with 120 IQ, oh, they deserve to live. They deserve to have liberty rights. Anytime you start making some kind of a distinction, on what justice or what rights, or even if non-maleficence can be practiced toward a person on the basis of some quality other than their humanity. If you're 6 foot tall, sorry, you don't have any rights. But if you're over 6 feet, good, you can have rights. You can, non-maleficence can be practiced for you. So, of course, anytime we see that these distinctions have been made, we see that it leads not just to marginalization, though certainly that, not just to massive injustice, though certainly that, not just to slavery and ostracization, though certainly that, but genocide, genocide, genocide. I mean, look at what happened, with the Indians in South America. Oh, you want to live on your own reductions and you don't want to be subjugated to the colonizers? We're going to kill you. And we're going to kill every last one of you. I mean, Hitler, I mean, get rid of all the inferiors. You got to get rid of all these gene bases, you know, these inferior gene bases, et cetera, et cetera. So notice then that any time you have some sort of favoritism, some humans are superior, some inferior, it causes the worst atrocities on the level of basic liberties, basic rights, basic justice, and at the end of the day, can even lead to the worst violation of all, which of course is a genocide. And we've seen it again and again. I guarantee you, every time you see a genocide, watch this whole idea of subhuman or something like that. The vocabulary is always, you know, winding its way in of there's a distinction we can make, of who is a more deserving human being. All human beings must be given, and evaluated at full human potential and thought to be equally deserving and to have an equal share of rights. And so another way of looking at this principle is the universalization of justice for every human being, the universalization of rights for every human being, the universalization of just treatment for every human being. So the idea is everybody gets it. There's no exceptions made. Anytime you try to put in an IQ feature or a height feature or a weight feature, or, you know, obviously I'm blind, you start saying blind people and look at the different kinds of things that are being also talked about in social engineering. Well, blind people, you just better not let them live. I mean, they've got a defect there, or somebody who's got, the Nazis clearly, oh, cleft palate, sorry, you don't deserve to live. Anytime you have any non-universalization going on, you're going to have the most monstrous, unethical violations of the principle of non-maleficence imaginable.
The consequences of denying that principle of full human potential are immense, you know. But this moves us perfectly into the next category, which is the principles of justice and natural rights. Because you're saying those have to be applied to everybody. But what are those principles? And so first is the principle of natural rights. And what is that? And how does that affect how we treat other people?
Yeah, I mean, again, this is one of those principles that came out of the school of Salamanca, a Spanish school. And the particular person here was Francisco Suarez. He was a Jesuit priest, but he belonged to the school of Salamanca. Molina, of course, all the economic principles that came out of the school of Salamanca are there as well. But anyway, Francisco Suarez in 1520 also in 1512, he had his theory of rights was first articulated in his Disputatione Metaphysicae. But anyway, he basically put it this way. Suarez, he was living in a culture that was converting from relational view of the human being to the individual human being. And science had actually kind of unleashed this thing of, you know, individuality is what counts. And so he was trying to adapt, well, is there any kind of justice, like minimal justice, that we can say belongs to every human being, right? We got to keep that universal principle in mind that we just saw, that belongs to every human being by their very human existence, by their very human nature. And so Suarez said, yeah, there are four such things that will tell, you know, define minimum justice. And what do you mean by minimum justice? You absolutely need these four things in order for a person to be a human being and to act like a human being. So what were those four things? Well, obviously, you need life in order to be a human being and act like a human being. Hello, of course. Number two, you absolutely need freedom, what Suarez would have called self-governance. You have to have some custodianship over your beliefs, custodianship over your ability to relate to others, so long as you're not harming anyone. So there has to be some freedom of movement, not just for yourself, but also for your family. So you have to, you know, there has to not only be an individual, but an interpersonal, familial kind of freedom where you can govern how your personhood, you as a person and you as a family can govern itself. Without that, you couldn't be a human being. You couldn't act like a human being. Human beings are free by their very nature. They have the capacity for self-governance by their very nature. They have the capacity to think of goals and objectives that they want to fulfill by their very nature. No other human being, I mean, no other creature besides human beings has it, because as Endel Tolving has showed, no other being has the capacity for future anticipatory self-consciousness and the capacity to see their self-consciousness in various future scenarios. It's exclusive to human beings. But every human being has that capacity. And therefore, if you're going to act like a human being, you got to be able to be free in your own personhood, your family as well. Third, Suarez calls it property. You have to have a certain amount of property that can be your own. You can't simply say, oh, well, I can own your food. I can own your shelter. I can own everything about you. But I can't own you because that'd be a violation of your freedom. I would be enslaving you. But I can own everything. You got to get it from the Spitzer Business Corporation. You got to get your food. You got to get your shelter. I own your property. And, you know, by the time you're done, if I own everything that could control your life, you know as well as I do, your home will not be your castle. You know as well as I do that basically I control everything that's going to happen by controlling the means that you need to exercise your freedom. In other words, I can basically control you. I've got you in indentured servitude, pure and simple. And so you can see that indentured servitude is another form of slavery. And so he says you've got to have some private property, some minimal amount of property that can belong to you without being controlled from outside by a state or by some other governing agent, like a family or a fiefdom or a feudal fiefdom or something like that. Okay, so property. And the fourth thing he says is the pursuit of happiness. Now, happiness was a very sophisticated term for people, not just the Salamanca school, in Spain there, but it goes back much further than that to the time of St. Augustine and much further back than that to Cicero and so forth and so on, and much further back than that to the great Nicomachean Ethics of Aristotle, in which Aristotle said, happiness is the one thing you can choose for itself. Everything else is chosen for the sake of happiness. So your very freedom is constituted by the fact that you not only can think of a goal that you want to achieve, think of what a future objective that will make you happy, that will make you fulfilled, that will give you the dignity you believe you deserve, that will allow you to exercise your creativity to its fullest potential. Those are the things that make human beings happy, right? We're happy not just when we're eating a bowl of spaghetti, but we're happy when we are creative. We're happy when we're productive. We're happy when we're learning things and making ourselves more productive. We're happy when we're contributing to others. We're happy when we can make a difference to the world around us. We're happy when we can practice our religion. We're happy when we can relate to God in the transcendent. All these things make us happy. And so what Suarez is trying to say here is, we not only have the right to choose what we think will make us happy, that's really important, of course, it's the most important decision of our lives, but at the very same time, we've got to have a culture, an ambiance out there that will allow us to do that. So what Suarez says is think of the four natural rights. Think of these natural rights as something which belongs to a human being. It's almost like it's a debt of payment that the entire world owes to each and every one of us. We have a debt of payment. We have a something that belongs to us, an accounts receivable from every human being around the world. I have the right, we would say, but everybody around the world has the obligation to give me, to allow me to live, to allow me to be free, to allow me to have enough property so I'm not an indentured servant, and to allow me to not only choose my happiness, but to carve my path to happiness, to find my way to happiness by my own industry and creativity. Everybody owes everybody, right? There's the debt, the obligation, Everybody owes that to everybody. And that accounts receivable, if I can put it that way, it belongs to every single one. When we are born into the world, says Suarez, we're born into the world with this obligation from everybody to allow us to be a human being and act like a human being.
Father, that sets us up perfectly for the next principle and my next question. The next principle is the principle of the fundamentality of rights. And that asserts what you're saying, the most fundamental rights are those necessary for the possibility of others. But Father, you know, how then do you suggest a society prioritize rights when it seems like one person's rights conflicts with another person's?
Of course, good question. In order to determine how to rank the rights or to make it a hierarchy of rights, in order to do that, you've got to use those first three principles of truth. And so you want, first of all, objective evidence, right? And then you want non-contradiction. And of course, you want the most complete explanation possible. So we want to implement those principles. Well, non-contradiction and necessity go hand in hand. So since the time of Suarez, and by the way, Francisco Suarez definitely he influenced Hugo Grotius, the father of international law. Hugo Grotius, in turn, influenced John Locke. Remember the second treatise on government, which Jefferson and so forth in our country had read. And that, of course, influenced Thomas Jefferson for the Declaration of Independence. And we now see the same inalienable rights in the United Nations Charter on Human Rights, et cetera. So it's everywhere present, these natural rights. But the main thing to remember is, how do you adjudicate, as you said, between a woman's right to privacy versus the fetus's right, the preborn human being's right to live? And the first thing is, we got to say which rights are more important than the other. And here's what all the logicians and all the philosophers, no exception in the whole history of philosophy, determined: the necessity criterion. Any right which is necessary for the very possibility of another right must be the higher right. Sometimes we call it the more fundamental right. So if the right to life is necessary for the very possibility of the right to freedom, then the right to life has to be a more important right, a precedential right over the right to freedom. There can be no doubt about that. You can't have freedom without life. And of course, it's very necessary, but you could have life without freedom. So it's not reciprocal. So life has to be a higher right than, and of course, you can pretty much see, hey, if you're dead, your freedom rights are a moot question. So yeah, your right to life has got to take precedence over the right to freedom. But then now we have to take a look at the other thing. And of course, we know that the challenge has gone out there that, well, if the fetus were really proven to be a human being, why, then we would know that the fetus's life rights must take precedence over the woman's privacy rights. But therein lies the doubt whether, you know, a human being is free. Go back to the criterion of evidence, that of objective evidence, that third principle that we brought out. And today, there's no excuse. And the Dobbs decision actually intimates and hints at this, but there's no excuse. Science today can show without any question that that single-celled human being, at the moment of fertilization, at single-celled zygote, that a unicellular zygote in the technical language is a substantially whole human being to which you will not add one single thing over the course of its existence. How can science do that? Two criteria are now determinable. Number one, science can show through DNA sequencing indisputably that the full human genome, every single part of the human genome to produce a specific, unique, and totally unique human being and none other than a human being is present at the very moment of fertilization at the unicellular zygote stage, attached or unattached. That full genome is present. And that's what you need in order for, you know, the totipotent cell called the zygote cell, that it is going to develop into a human being. So the first thing is all the information is there to make a Bob Spitzer a Bob Spitzer or a Catherine Hadro a Catherine Hadro, at least in the, what we call the non-epigenetic sense. All the major factors are there to determine all the cellular divisions that you will go through in your life in order to produce an adult, a Catherine Hadro, and even to an elderly Catherine Hadro to the end of your life. So the main thing is that's part one. But part two that's there is you have a very special cell at fertilization. It's not like any other cell in the human body, like a skin cell or a muscle cell or a bone cell, right? This cell is called a zygote. It's called a totipotent cell. It is the kind of cell that can become any kind of cell, a skin cell, a bone cell, et cetera. It can become any kind of cell out there. So here you've got a totipotent cell, and we know definitively that your totipotent cell on the day you were, moment you were fertilized, the very moment at which that happened, that totipotent cell was there with your specific full human genome. And what did that do? That totipotent cell is going to be the origin of every single cell in your body for the rest of your life. And that DNA, that full human genome, is going to determine all the cell multiplications of that one cell throughout the course of your entire life. All the products are there. All the materials are there. All the formal mechanisms for your cell to become your postborn body, your adult body, your elderly body, every single one of them, it's all there. In other words, you are a substantially whole human being at the moment of your conception. Fertilization. And that is objectively verifiable. Any other opinion can be shown to be, through good objective evidence, dead wrong. That's why embryological textbooks, et cetera, have adjusted that. In the latest surveys of biologists all around the world, it's very clear, right, that international biologists, I think this was a survey of someone like 5,800 international biologists, something of that nature, that 96% of those biologists all agree that the conception or fertilization of the human zygote, the two gametes coming together and forming a single zygote, that moment is the moment at which a new, unique, substantially whole human being comes into existence. 96% internationally. And then, of course, in the United States, we have another survey in which 68% of biologists agree, but it was a different kind of survey. It gave them a chance to at least fill in the blank about other possibilities that they want to consider. But still a supermajority of biologists say that the new, unique human genome comes into existence right at that moment, that totipotent zygote plus the full human genome, which is together and already, starting the process of cell replication, it's already there at the single cell fertilization stage. You are a substantially whole human being. You put those two things together, that, right? Number one, the right to life is higher than the right to liberty. Now we can tell you that with certainty that the pre-born human being at the moment of its fertilization conception, whether he or she is, whether it's a he or a she or anything else, it's all substantially whole. Now you can say, well, we can make a reasonable, on the basis of these principles, a reasonable assessment of whether that fetus's right to life is higher than the woman's liberty rights or property rights. Of course it is. The necessity criterion requires it. Right to life is necessary for the very possibility of right to liberty, which it is, because as I said, if you're dead, your freedom rights are a moot question. Then the rights of that fetus, the rights of that embryo, the rights of that zygote to live are to be evaluated as a higher priority and of greater significance than a woman's right to privacy.
So you've sort of illustrated this principle of limits of freedom, that one's freedom should not be imposed, shouldn't impose undue burdens on another's freedom, and you point out how these principles of reason are sort of what undergird that. I think the whole point of we can use the objective evidence to show that if we can't, the freedom of life, is a higher good than sort of the freedom of autonomy for the pregnant woman, and using reason to uphold that principle, these natural rights and justice, and you can see the sort of the interrelationship. They don't stand by themselves. They're all sort of worketh as a whole, which I think then brings us to that last sort of category.
Yes. And so as we're concluding this conversation through all these categories and principle, that through the 10 universal principles, there's what you term as the fundamental principle, which is the principle of beneficence or the golden rule. So can you speak about this and why it is the golden rule?
Well, prior to Jesus, as I said, the silver rule was always out there because it's ethical minimalism. Do not do unto others what you would not have them do unto you. Don't do an unnecessary harm to others. If a harm's unavoidable, minimize it. That's in every culture. It's in every religion, north, south, east, and west, without exception. Okay, then you take a look at the golden rule, and that really doesn't come into being until Jesus. Jesus is the one that takes the knots out of the silver rule, and he makes it, instead of non-maleficence, which means do no harm, do no evil, it makes it the principle of beneficence. Do the optimal good for others that you would want done to you. So when Jesus says, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, he's not talking about just avoiding harms. He's talking about doing the good for another being, human being, that you would want done to you. So he's now turning this into ethical maximalism. So Jesus tells his followers, Well, I certainly agree with the silver rule, you know, don't do any unnecessary harm. But I want you to do more. I would like you to get out there and try to do the good for others that you would want done to you, to make progress, to educate people if they need education, and to educate or to take care of people's health care if they need taken care of, that you would want done to you. Of course, I can't enjoin you under strict justice to do good for other people beyond avoiding unnecessary harms. Yes, to do an unnecessary harm is a justice issue. But I mean, to do the good for people beyond avoiding unnecessary harms, well, I'm telling you as my followers, this is my Heavenly Father's will. So he doesn't try to philosophically justify it. There are implications that doing the good for others is going to improve culture and improve society. And certainly when Jesus told the church this, and the church went out and implemented it, they went out right away. I mean, there was no stopping them. They tried right away to educate even the slaves. The slaves had no rights whatsoever. So educating of slaves came right away and beyond. It didn't have to be a Christian. Just come one, come all. The Christians who have the capacity to educate you will do so. Same thing with if you need public health, you can come to the Christians. Go ahead and do that. It's they're doing this out of charity, not out of justice. They're not enjoying by justice to do health care. The same thing with public welfare. So they, you know, church was starting orphanages and starting all kinds of, you know, places and means. The poor boxes that were established in every church all over the Roman Empire until finally, of course, by the time the Edict of Milan and Constantine makes the Christian church the religion of Rome, we can see that, you know, the world is totally transformed by the golden rule. Literally, you can see that because of the church, there's more education, more social welfare, and more public health than could have ever been envisioned year after year. And the thing was, the church did this while it was being publicly persecuted for 250 years. What's even more interesting is that has remained to this very day. If you just look at the Catholic Church, just for examples, the Catholic Church is still the largest international public healthcare institution in the world. It oversees 24% of all healthcare in the world, and then of course, Catholic Church is still the biggest public education international public education system in the world. In other words, the current, there were 98,000 primary schools and 46,000 secondary schools and 1,760 universities. I mean, by far, the biggest international education. The same thing for public welfare. I mean, tens of thousands of orphanages, tens of thousands of clinics to help people who are having some, mental challenges and difficulties and emotional challenges and difficulties and things of that nature. You just look at it, and Jesus did, in fact, transform the world with this principle, this one little principle. He takes out the knots, and boy, does it go, almost crazy, do the good for others you want done to you, and it was world transformative. And is this going to be important in terms of other issues like slavery? Of course. Is it important for pro-life issues? Of course, we want to do the good for every human being. It's not good enough just to avoid harm, says Jesus. He says, I can't avoid, I can't enjoin you to do this. I can't force you to do the good for others. We can't, as a government, enjoin that on people, but can we use it as a cultural norm, as a religious norm within a culture to make culture better? Absolutely we can. And we should, because look at the way it's transformed. If the Christian church had not gone ahead and done what it did, to be honest, we would live in a very different world today, and it would not be for the better. And by the way, you wouldn't even have any rights theory today, because that came out of the Christian church, and you wouldn't even have a UN Charter of Rights, let alone a Declaration of Human Rights in the United States and the Declaration of Independence. Just saying. I mean, it would be a very different world. and not for the better.
Yeah, it's interesting. You made the point that all 10 of these principles, particularly that last one, are undergirded by sort of Christianity and Catholicism. And you point out how to support human dignity here as we wrap up, you know, like democracy or legal systems alone can't do it, right? You have to have these 10 principles and how they're all related and so forth. But do you see one in your mind that really seems to be under attack right now that we're losing? Is there one in particular that you would say, you know what, this is one that, you know, in our culture today, we're starting to give up?
I see three of them that are correlated. We're giving up the principle of non-maleficence for sure. I mean, I've never seen so much excuse being poured out for violating the rights of elderly people, violating the right to life of not just the pre-born human beings. Now you've got people over at Princeton University that are basically talking about, why stop at in utero? If you see a birth defect or you see a genetic defect in a little baby, why you should have up to a year to euthanize that baby. I mean, I'm not kidding you. Peter Singer's coming out and he's saying this. Straight outright. And furthermore, I would have to say that that's being combined. So the principle of non-maleficence is being combined up now with just an absolute neglect of natural rights. I mean, look at the justification from Roe v. Wade. It's the same justification that was used for Dred Scott versus Sanford. Basically, they used an opposite logic. Instead of assuming that any human being has rights until proven otherwise, they said, no, you should assume that human beings don't have rights until their existence can be justified as deserving to live. So when, for example, they did the Dred Scott decision, that's, of course, well over 100 years ago, but when they did that, they basically said, look, we've searched the Constitution, so forth and so on. There's nothing providing the Constitution, that says that Black people of African descent, that they have any kind of rights under United States government whatsoever. So we can deprive them of it. Just look at the opposite logic that is happening here. It's the abandonment of natural rights. They completely forgot that those Black Americans had the natural right that belonged to them themselves, not some extrinsically declared right by the U.S. Constitution or government or courts. But basically, they have it in themselves, and no government can take it away. That's the logic upon which our Declaration of Independence was made. That's the logic that was used to separate ourselves from Great Britain. Now, you look at the same thing with Roe v. Wade. It's the very same logic. They totally forgot the inalienable, that is to say, the natural rights of preborn human beings. There's no excuse anymore. On the basis of science, you can prove that that is indisputably a substantially whole and unique human being at the stage of fertilization. No excuse to say, well, there's ambiguity. There is no ambiguity on the basis of science. So if you take that at face value, then you have to ask, you know, how could you possibly justify the abortion? Because it violates the natural, the inalienable, which belongs to every human being. Universality of right. Every human being in themselves belongs to them. You cannot violate that by any positive law. Remember what St. Augustine said that became the marching orders of every single movement of civil disobedience. An unjust law is no law at all.
Father Robert Spitzer, thank you so much for speaking with such clarity on what our culture needs to hear right now. We all need this great reminder. Grateful for your time, for your intellect, and your wisdom. Father, thank you.
Thank you.
It's great to welcome Father Spitzer back onto the podcast. And again, we could speak to him on so many different topics, but really helpful to hear his thoughts on these different principles. What stood out to you?
Yeah, the interrelatedness of all the principles is, stood out to me and how they all depend upon each other, and particularly the foundation of reason there, when we're trying to talk about natural rights and sort of how do you apply those? He goes back, well, you got to look at, you know, these principles of non-contradiction and, you know, objective evidence. And I think that's one of the things that we tend to be losing as a society, this grounding things in objective evidence, right? And it's just, oh, you know, you're using objective evidence to, you know, take away my rights. And it's like, well, no, we're using objective evidence so that we can have a discussion that we can all sort of enter into, right? Rather than just my view and your view, and nobody can enter into a discussion with anybody, and it's just a shouting match, you know?
None of us, you know, so often are we not on the same page with people. How can we even begin to have a conversation when we can't even agree on the most basic?
Right. And without those foundational principles, we're not ever going to be get back to a rational discussion about things.
Now, as we were talking through and walking through those different principles, I was just thinking how we fall so far from a number of them and how that's reflected in what JP2 called our culture of death today, right? And I think, and we spoke through some of those examples, but again, we ended on what was that 10th principle, but it was the golden principle, right? And that's what Jesus taught, do unto others as you would like to be done unto you. And that is not about reason, right? That's fully, solely about love and selflessness and love for the other person.
Right. Yeah. It's not irrational. It goes above reason. It's not something that we can enforce. You know, we can't have, like Father Spitzer saying, you have a law saying you have to, you know, do good to others. You can have a law says that you can't kill another person, but to say, well, you got to be kind and, you know, and look out for their best interest. That has to come from someplace else other than litigation, right? But it is. It's the highest principle that again animates all the other ones. Because if you're doing all the other ones with love, that see how they all unite together, and you're not doing it out of fear of being caught, but you're doing these other principles out of love.
Yeah. No. Absolutely. This is a great reminder, and again, a call to action for all of us to how to better implement that into our everyday. So again, a big thank you to Father Spitzer. All right, but Dan, that means I now have some questions for you as we pivot to the office hours segment of the podcast. And, you know, some of these questions were submitted to me that people are wondering, and I think dovetailed nicely following our conversation with Father Spitzer. One question is this. Dan, can you speak about the reality of the sentience of a fetus and at which point they feel pain?
Yeah, that's it's an interesting question because a lot of people use that as a justification for abortion at certain periods of time. And so, you know, just in general, nobody's really sure exactly when a fetus can, the baby can feel pain. There is some evidence, maybe it's, you know, 22 to 24 weeks when like the cortex, the folded portion of our brain that's responsible for, you know, important for our conscious experience, wires up with the rest of the brain. So people say, well, before that, they can't really feel pain. Mm-hmm. But there's other evidence that sort of suggests that that's not fully true. The premature infants, you know, 22 weeks, 23 weeks, it does seem that they are feeling pain even before that 23, 24 week threshold. And there's certain pain sensitive neurons that develop and wire up before then. Exactly what their sensation of pain is, you know, nobody, that's a subjective thing. There's no way to know exactly. But I think the bigger thing there is that even if we knew for sure, and we could say, well, they don't feel pain until 20 weeks, that doesn't then mean that before 20 weeks, you can do whatever you want with the fetus. They don't have certain rights. And that's what Father Spitzer was sort of getting at today. It's like, once you draw a line, oh, you're 6 feet tall, you have rights. You're under 6 feet, you don't. If you feel pain, you have rights. If you don't feel pain, you draw this arbitrary distinction. Well, what is it? Why is it when you have feel pain,
right,
that you now become a human person? Because at a week post-conception, you probably can't feel pain, but you're doing some marvelous things that you and I can't do. Like an embryo that's 7 days old can actually split and form two lives, right?
Yeah, so I can't do that.
So it is what it is, what a human is supposed to be at 7 days, right? And it is fully a human person at that stage. And it's doing exactly what you would expect a seven-day-old person to do.
It's dangerous territory when we start defining this person is human, this person is not.
Right, based on some attribute.
Right.
So why pain? You know, right. Why not hair color? You know, it's like, yeah. it's arbitrary at that point.
Well, here's a different question that was also submitted. And again, always a buzzworthy topic that someone wanted to know. From your perspective, again, as a biologist, how does hormonal contraception affect a woman's body? Truly.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of what it does to prevent pregnancy, right, it basically suppresses the woman's natural rhythm, which is like every month, you have certain oocytes that mature and then get ovulated, and the hormones, and there's different types and a whole bunch of different classes of hormonal contraception, but in general, they all sort of prevent the maturation, the normal maturation process, and the ovulation of the woman's normal reproductive cycle. So what it's doing is taking something that's inherently normal and healthy for the woman and blocking that, right? And saying we're gonna stop what the body normally wants to do during, you know, the time that a woman is normally fertile. And so anytime you do that to stop sort of normal function, you're going to have certain side effects, right? And that we do know, probably the most, you know, well-known, you know, side effect is that the hormonal contraceptives lead to increase in blood clots, like 3 to 5 time fold increased risk. It causes changes in the level of clotting and anti-clotting factors. So you have an abnormal blood clot and cause a stroke and so forth. So it's there, you know, it also causes other minor side effects in terms of mood and bloating and other issues and bleeding and so forth. But that's not surprising given, you know, the fact that you're blocking sort of the normal processes that are happening, the normal physiological function that the woman's body is designed to have going on every month.
Well, helpful for that response. I know some listeners and viewers will be as well. And with that, that kicks us off for season 5. I can't believe it. I'm looking forward to the next episodes to come.
Yeah, it's great. I'm looking forward to this last season and these sort of more integrated topics of what it means to be human and flourish in human society.
Absolutely. And again, make sure to go to MajaCenter.com to see the latest about Purposeful Lab and to subscribe at your favorite podcast platform. We'll see you next week.